something went wrong and she was attacked. And so she told me whether in fact it happened. She said that she wasn't ever going to try to go home again. It was better to live in Gambaga, and at least she has peace of mind there. And Zanago, the woman whose son is the first child at the camp to go to secondary school, she actually made a choice when her husband fell ill. She moved from the town back into the camp because she thought it would be better for the children and also for her peace of mind if she was there. And she was there for educational reasons, but she was there also because if she had gone back with her husband, it's likely that her husband's relatives would have thought that she had been responsible for his stroke. Yeah, and so some women actually choose Gambaga as a place where, even though life is hard, they can actually not be under attack. You know, they don't have to go through all the rigmarole of whenever a child is ill, then you're accused. In fact, Azara, the reason, you know, the one who is the film is partly memory of, she had actually gone back home and was staying with her brother in the brother's compound. But then a child, I think after about 6 months, a child had been left to play by a boiling water cauldron, and the child fell in and was very, very badly burned. And Azara, without waiting for any accusation, just got up and went back. Yeah. Because she knew what people would be thinking. Though nobody accused her, she decided it was better for her to be back at Gambaga.
How much has it been screened in Ghana, and what has the response been? And I mean, it's like
tried to remove it because nothing would please the press more than a catfight between women purporting to be feminists. And so that was removed. But apart from that, the response has been very, very good. It's been shown at universities in Ghana, and it is also being used at the University of Ghana. Every single student who enters the university, the main university of Ghana, it watches the film as part of African studies and gender studies and discusses it and comments on it. And as far as Gambaga itself and the witches' camp is concerned, since the film has been made, no woman is forced now to work on the chief's land if they don't want to. They can say, no, I don't want to work for the chief. They're being paid more when they do actually provide their labour to within the community. And a pavilion has been built for them so that they can actually congregate and meet and you know, and it's a sort of space for them. And then on top of that, the Presbyterian Church is using the film to get funds for that project. And they've now got regular sponsors and are able to do more outreach. So it's had, a good effect on them.
Of techniques in the production.
took hold of me and I did this. And when you're working with, well, I just thought, how do I actually visualize superstition? Or how do I visualize, I mean, superstition is derogatory. How do I put into pictures a very different system of belief which operates with you know, a world you can touch and feel? And so I discussed this with my cameraman, Darren, together, he suggested, and I thought it was a great idea, that and the things he filmed, or, you know, were to do with, came out of the research I've done as to why, you know, what it is about women makes them witches. And I think part of the reason is that women are actually cooking and doing things, reproductive things, which means they have incredible, if a woman wants to poison a man, he's dead. You know, it's very easy to, because, you know, you're dealing in foodstuff, so it was actually a conscious thing to actually film all those very, very ordinary things, and also because that's what the women were doing, cooking. But we decided to actually film those sequences using a fairly, you know, ordinary video camera. Hardy, but on a slow shutter speed. So you get that Super 8 sort of slightly blurry. And so that was used to sort of try to bring out that sort of, I guess, more sinister aspect, and also used it when people were telling their stories. So when it's a flashback thing, we would use that to sort of make that distinction between the here and now and what had happened. So it's a technique that we decided to use to illustrate more visually the sort of various layers of reality that people were operating within.
Yeah, I was also very struck by just how it relaxed so many of the women became, you know, with having a camera in front of them, and how relaxed they were about being able to speak about very difficult moments in their life, and even to move into such intimate spaces as the home of the village, and to have, and to really catch it in a way where, you know, people were feeling a bit shy of being able to be in camera. How did you feel that there was a set period of time that it took people to actually become accustomed to being in their space and shooting this documentary and becoming comfortable with the camera and this kind of technology?
My relationship with the community goes back to 1995 when I first went there. And I've been a couple of times before I went to do the research. So, the chief got to know me somewhat. And then the other thing was doing the research. I was there for about 2 months, a month. Very intensive. And, you know, going with Larrabah. The group of women who were willing to talk were self-selecting. You know, there were women who, you know, were around, and when I approached them, after they start, they said, no, I don't want to do this. And Zinago, for instance, after she talked to me, because it's very, very painful. It's about, you know, often people have tried to kill you. People have tortured you. And people have rejected you at a very, very fundamental level. And after Zinago, jealous of her. And so when she eventually returned home, because, you know, her husband had died and people were accusing her of witchcraft in her husband's family, so she returned home. And then her brothers saw an opportunity to get their own back on her. So what they did was they, you know, an accusation came up again. She went to her father's room, thinking that she'd be safe there. And she described very vividly, this came out only after about, you know, a several conversations. She describes holding on to her husband, her father's robe, and her brothers pulling her away and beating her and threatening to kill her. And of course, it's a sort of insurrection. That the father, that they were doing this to their father because the father had preferred her. Do you see what I mean? So there's a lot of sort of almost Greek visceral to do with sibling rivalry, attack on the father, you know, all of this is happening all over the world, and it comes out in witchcraft accusations. Yeah.
Mostly by an Ivorian singer called Dobe Nyahore, now based in France and Belgium. And I was looking for music for a short promo I was doing. And my brother, who's based in Canada, said, "Oh, you must really listen to Dobe Nyahore's music." He said, "There's a track that would do." I said, "I want something very, a woman's voice, very soulful and very you know, melodic, and she said, well, you should check out this singer. And so I did, and there was another singer, I think she's from Rokia Traore, but she was, her agent was asking for about 1,000 pounds for about a couple of seconds. And that, you know, I just didn't have the money. But when I approached Dobe Nyarore, she said she thought it was a very good project, and she was willing to let me use her music for nothing, because she thought it was good. And so I said, look, therefore, can I give you a token payment? And can I use a lot of your music? And she said, fine. And I just think it just goes well with the images. So it's her music, and also there's a Ghanaian group called Gonje, that's managed by a friend of mine, and I used some Gonje music, and I used some old highlight music, but that I paid the usual going rates. But Dobe Nyarore, whose music goes from the start to the finish, you know, she just was extremely generous, very, very generous. Stripped naked in front of just taunting.